It will play an important role in one of the most significant economic events in Australian history, and that's the transformation from fossil fuels to an economy powered by renewable energy and clean industries.
That's Greg Combo, the chair of Australia's new Net Zero Economy Authority. Mr. Combo was a guest only this week on the Australia's National Press Club. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Let's listen now to the first few minutes from Greg Combe's presentation at the Australian National Press Club, and you'll find a link for the entire presentation in the show notes.
Today at the National Press Club, Greg Combe. Mr. Combe is chair of the government's new Net Zero Economy Authority. The new agency has been tasked with working with those communities most exposed to the green energy transition on Australia's pathway to net zero. Greg Combe with today's address.
Hello and welcome to the National Press Club of Australia for today's Westpac address. My name is Julie Hare. I'm a director of the club here and I'm the education editor at the Australian Financial Review. Our guest today is Greg Combe, AM, the chair of the Net Zero Economy Agency, and has been so since July 2023. He will complete his term in the middle of the year. He will become then the chair of the Future Fund. The clean energy and net zero debate is at the forefront of government policy and the Australian community. Mr. Combe has had an extensive career in public life and incredibly well resumed to do the job. Sorry about that. Prior to this role, he recently served as the chair of IFM Investors and Industry Super Australia. Mr. Combe was formerly Minister for Climate Change and Energy Efficiency, Minister for Industry and Innovation, Minister for Defence Personnel, Science and Material, and a leader of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. Prior to 2007, Mr. Combe had a long and high-profile trade union career that involved numerous industry restructurings. Mr. Combe was awarded a Member of the Order of Australia in 2006 for service to industrial relations. For those of you watching at home, you can join the conversation on Twitter or X, where our handle is @PressClubAust, or you can use the hashtag MPC. Please welcome Greg Combe.
Thank you very much, Julie. I'd firstly like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we stand here today at the Press Club, the Ngunnawal people, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. And I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people both here at the Press Club and amongst the wider audience. There's quite a few familiar faces here today. Thank you to everyone for coming to the club, and thanks to those who've come in continuance of this long journey in climate policy. Today, as Julie pointed out, I address you as chair of the Net Zero Economy Agency, and a position I took up in July last year and which I will conclude on the 31st of May. On the 1st of June, also as Julie mentioned, I'll begin a new role as chair of Australia's Future Fund, a real privilege. By that time, though, I aim to have discharged the responsibilities that the Prime Minister and the Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen, asked me to undertake. And they were to build a new statutory authority, the Net Zero Economy Authority, that will promote the orderly and positive economic transformation of Australia as the world cuts greenhouse gas emissions and fossil fuel dependence. Also, to ensure that workers and regions are supported through this process and realise and share the benefits and opportunities of the new net zero economy, and to help Australia become a renewable energy superpower. And my instructions from the boss were clear. develop a plan that will help people and communities through change, respect their interests, create opportunities, and leave no one behind. And to me, they're the best of Australian values, and when we're facing significant change, it's important we draw upon them. To go about this task, I've drawn on every bit of my experience in the coal industry originally, as a trade union leader in politics and in government, and as an institutional investor. I've had the privilege also of working with a team of very capable and dedicated public servants, a highly skilled advisory board, and a very supportive PM and Minister in Chris Bowen. The legislation to create the Net Zero Economy Authority was introduced to the House of Representatives last week, and it will, when enacted, replace the agency that I currently head. Today I'd like to outline for you what that authority will do. It will play an important role in one of the most significant economic events in Australian history, and that's the transformation from fossil fuels to an economy powered by renewable energy and clean industries. A lot has changed in the field of climate policy in the decade or more since I served as Minister for Climate Change in the Gillard government. I think that was the last occasion upon which I spoke here. The subsequent global agreement to an emissions reduction target of net zero by 2050 has been transformative. The debate surrounding climate science has largely settled, and a global consensus has emerged that action, serious action, is needed to cut greenhouse gas emissions to address the dangerous impacts of climate change. Lived experience, I think, is having a big influence on people. More frequent and more devastating natural disasters. Temperature records set and exceeded, with last year recording the highest average temperatures in 174 years of record keeping. For Australia, I've likened the scale and significance of the net zero transformation to post-war reconstruction. And that's because of our economy's reliance on fossil fuels. In the 2022-23 financial year alone, the total value of Australian coal and liquefied natural gas exports was almost $220 billion. That's more than 30% of the value of our total exports. Taxes and royalties from fossil fuels play a big part in sustaining our standard of living and government service provision. But as the world changes, demand for our fossil fuel exports will of course decline. Countries with net zero commitments represent 97% of the value of Australian exports. Now that's a very significant figure for an emissions intensive export like ours. So change is coming, and in fact it's well underway. For Australia though, I think this is a story of great opportunity. We are uniquely endowed with abundant renewable energy and mineral resources, a skilled and resilient workforce, engineering and technical capability, large pools of capital. We have a stable investment environment and are a reliable trading partner. And right now, we can seize the chance to use these endowments to secure prosperity for future and current generations. In my role, I've found optimism about the future in the practical action and the positivity and determination of people when visiting Australia's industrial regions. These communities are now readying themselves for the opportunities of a renewable powered economy. And that's a different story to the time when I was climate minister and travelling around the regions 10 or 12 years ago. Governments, businesses and investors are making concrete plans for a low emissions future. To me, the economic argument is simple. As our trading partners pursue their own emissions reduction targets and wealth from our fossil fuel exports decline, we must create new sources of wealth from industries powered by renewable energy. And at the same time, support people, workers, communities and regions through this change. And there's absolutely no doubt about our collective capacity to do it and do it well.
It's getting wet on Australia's east coast. Let's listen now to this Bureau of Meteorology report from the New Daily.
A very wet end to the week is on the way for much of New South Wales as a trough deepens along the east coast. Let's jump in with a look at today first of all. We're likely to see fairly patchy showers along eastern parts of the New South Wales coast with fairly low rainfall totals expected. A trough extending through northeast New South Wales and southern Queensland may generate some heavier falls in these parts, particularly with thunderstorms this afternoon. The story will start to change from tomorrow, however, with much wetter weather starting to extend more broadly across northeastern New South Wales and down the east coast as well. Now, thunderstorms may bring heavy to locally intense rainfall to northeast New South Wales and southern Queensland, but for the rest of the New South Wales coast, more moderate falls is all that's expected unless we get those thunderstorms moving overhead. As we go through the later part of Thursday and into Friday, though, that's when we'll see the most severe weather starting to ramp up as a trough deepens off the east coast of New South Wales. Now, this trough is likely to drag in further moisture and direct it across eastern and central New South Wales, with the risk of heavy falls becoming more widespread and intense. We may also see strong winds wrapping around that trough and high seas and swell starting to be generated offshore. As we go through the day on Friday, we're going to start seeing a low pressure system starting to develop somewhere on that trough, most likely pushing towards the southern coast. The heaviest rain and the strongest winds are likely to be tied to wherever that low may develop, but there's still an element of uncertainty as to exactly when and where that will happen. But as we go into the overnight period into Saturday morning, though, we're likely to see it shifting south, taking the rain and the wind with it. We may see some rain and wind impacts for East Gippsland through the day on Saturday, but for the Central Coast and Sydney area, it'll be an easing weather pattern, with just patchier showers likely to be lingering across those areas through Saturday afternoon and evening. Now, the rainfall totals over the Thursday to Saturday period are likely to reach 1 to 200 millimetres across southern Queensland and much of eastern New South Wales. Isolated falls pushing above 200 millimetres about some of those coastal areas and with any storms that develop. Now, rainfall of this magnitude can quickly lead to flash flooding, cutting off our roads, making them impassable and blocking our drainage systems. We may also see riverine flooding developing through Friday and into Saturday, with flood warnings likely to be issued. In fact, a number of warnings are likely over the coming days, including warnings for heavy rain and flash flooding, damaging winds, particularly about the central coast, thunderstorms and hazardous surf. With a lot unfolding over the next few days, it is essential that you check the forecasts and warnings regularly via the Bureau's website and the Bomb Weather app, so that you and those that you know in these areas can stay as up to date and as safe as possible. We'll catch you in the next update.
Now we have 90 seconds from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Key deer are found in only one place, the Florida Keys, and they look like something out of a fairy tale. The deer are so tiny, they measure only about 2 feet at the shoulder.
They are very cute animals, and people love them.
That's Nikki Colangelo of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Her agency is working to protect the species. As seas rise and storms become more extreme, the ocean threatens to swallow much of the deer's habitat. Already, salt water is moving inland, so it's harder for the deer to find fresh water. To help, the agency is improving habitat in places on higher ground that are more protected from sea level rise. It's working with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to restore a large freshwater marsh system in Big Pine Key.
It's one of the higher elevation islands in the Keys, and where a large portion of the population currently occurs.
The project will help ensure that key deer have access to fresh water there.
That's something that we're hoping will buy time for us to continue to improve the habitat conditions for this key deer until hopefully we can do what's needed to slow climate change and sea level rise effects for the species in the future.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Check out this webpage from Yale Climate Connections. It talks about how climate change is affecting all types of weather. It discusses such things as wildfire, flooding, hurricanes, heat, drought, air quality, sea level rise, storms and winds. You'll find a link for that webpage in the show notes. Join me now as we listen to the audio from a story in the Melbourne Age by Nick O'Malley. It has the headline, After Years of Promises on Climate Change, Oil Giants Are Backtracking.
This month, Shell made its move. The world's second largest oil and gas company and largest LNG producer announced it was watering down its climate targets, its chief executive Wael Sawan fretting to Reuters that it was perilous for Shell to set 2035 emission reduction targets because there is too much uncertainty at the moment in the energy transition trajectory. Voicing his confidence that fossils would remain integral to the global energy mix in the longer term, Sawan added that there is going to be a multidimensional energy system in the future, and oil and gas will continue to have an important role in stabilizing that system for a long, long, long time to come. We are trying to focus our company, our organization, and our shareholders on a waypoint that's much clearer, which is 2030, Sawan said. He also announced a reduction in the company's 2030 targets. In 2020, as oil prices plunged toward zero, BP was at the forefront of a push by the oil and gas majors to remake themselves as diversified energy companies and drive faster into a renewable future. Its then chief executive Bernard Looney announced that the company would not only reach net zero by 2050, but that it would actively lobby for international carbon taxes. But a lot has changed since then. Looney was moved on, fairly unceremoniously, by his board in September 2023. More significantly, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine in February 2022, effectively knocking the second largest fossil fuel exporter on Earth out of the West's oil and gas market. By 2022, crude oil prices had surged to more than US$120, $184, a barrel, and it remains healthily above $80 a barrel today. In February last year, BP backtracked. During a quarterly earnings report, BP announced that it had made a record profit of US$27.7 billion over the previous year, more than double its 2021 profit, and that it was reducing its goals to cut oil production. In March last year, ExxonMobil abandoned its research to create low-emissions fuel from algae. Since 2009, the company had spent US$350 million on the effort, which it had used extensively in marketing to burnish its green credentials. The dirty secret nobody talks about is how much all this is going to cost and who's willing to pay for it, Chief Executive Darren Woods told Fortune last month of the world's quest to decarbonize. The people who are generating those emissions need to be aware of and pay the price for generating those emissions. That is ultimately how you solve the problem. That might be the case, but climate observers were unimpressed, particularly because ExxonMobil was already infamous for doing accurate cutting-edge early research into climate change, only to downplay the science publicly. It's like a drug lord blaming everyone but himself for drug problems, Gernot Wagner, a climate economist at Columbia Business School, told The Guardian. Then, as though to clarify the fossil sector's position, or perhaps to take its gloves off, the chief executive of the biggest of them all, Saudi Aramco, spoke even more bluntly during a panel discussion at a global energy conference in Texas earlier this month. We should abandon the fantasy of phasing out oil and gas, Amin Nasser said, to applause from the audience. A transition strategy reset is urgently needed, and my proposal is this. We should abandon the fantasy of phasing out oil and gas and instead invest in them adequately reflecting realistic demand assumptions. NASA spoke of hard realities and said that, in the real world, the current transition strategy is visibly failing on most fronts. He said alternative energy sources had failed to displace hydrocarbons at scale, noting that oil demand had increased by 100 million barrels of oil equivalent a day this century and would reach an all-time high this year. The increasing energy needs of developing nations would see demand remain high and grow until 2045, he said. We should phase in new energy sources and technologies when they are genuinely ready, economically competitive, and with the right infrastructure, NASA said. All this strengthens the view that peak oil and gas is unlikely for some time to come, let alone 2030, he said. No one is betting the farm on that. For governments and policymakers, the problem with NASA's real world is it conflicts with the other one, which has just sweltered through its hottest year in history due to carbon dioxide emissions, 70% of which come from the burning of fossil fuels. In this real world, global leaders gathered in Dubai in December for climate talks and after 2 weeks of hard-fought negotiations agreed to begin transitioning away from fossil fuels in energy systems in a just, orderly and equitable manner, so as to achieve net zero by 2050 in keeping with the science. The language was significant because fossil fuels have never before been explicitly referred to in a declaration of the UN climate talks, but talk of transitioning away fell far short of the language that around 130 of the 198 countries represented at the talks had called for. Those countries wanted fossil fuel companies and their investors to be put on notice with an agreement to phase out oil and gas. We have made an incremental advancement over business as usual when what we really needed is an exponential step change in our actions, said Anne Rasmussen from Samoa, the lead negotiator for the Alliance of Small Island States, to a standing ovation on the floor of the plenary session. It is not enough for us to reference the science and then make agreements that ignore what the science is telling us we need to do. The U.S. climate envoy, John Kerry, who pushed hard to secure the compromise, was more upbeat. For the very first time at a COP, fossil fuels have been on the table as a major part of our negotiations, he said. And the decision that came out of this clearly embraces transitioning away from fossil fuels in energy systems so as to achieve net zero by 2050. NASA's position also contradicts that of the International Energy Agency, an intergovernmental organization that has traditionally been closely identified with the fossil fuel industry. More recently in its analysis, the IEA has been blunt about the need for the world to transition and about its capacity to do so. In its annual World Energy Outlook report last year, the IEA predicted that fossil fuel demand would peak by 2030, before entering a plateau and slow decline. The transition to clean energy is happening worldwide, and it's unstoppable, IEA Chief Fadi Birol said in a statement at the time. Claims that oil and gas represent safe or secure choices for the world's energy and climate future look weaker than ever. As the IEA's position on fossils has drifted from that of the industry, criticism of it has ramped up. In Dubai, the OPEC Secretary-General Haitham Al-Gais accused Birol of unjustly vilifying the industry as being behind the climate crisis. But the IEA's analysis of the industry remains world-leading, and its data suggest that whatever the fossil majors are saying about long-term demand, their shareholders might not hold the same confidence. An IEA report on energy investment showed a significant decline in the amount of cash the industry was reinvesting in its production. Between 2008 and 2017, the figure hovered between 80 and 100%, then it declines. Last year, the sector ploughed just 50% of its cash back into the business, with the rest being doled out to shareholders. Uncertainties over longer-term demand, worries about costs, and pressure from many investors and owners to focus on returns rather than production growth mean only large Middle Eastern national oil companies are spending much more in 2023 than they did in 2022, and they are the only subset of the industry spending more than pre-pandemic levels, read the IEA's analysis. This is significant because the energy industry typically outlays vast amounts of capital exploiting a resource, say a new oil or gas field, and then uses the bulk of the return to develop the next one. Now it appears shareholders are demanding more of the cash is diverted to them rather than reinvested in future production. It looks like an industry that is enjoying a very profitable but ultimately terminal decline, says the energy analyst Tim Buckley, an advocate of renewables. We are still addicted to fossil fuels, we can't stop overnight, but we are stopping, he says. It also brings us back to those climate talks in Dubai. When the deal was struck, the COP28 President Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, himself an oil executive, celebrated it as historic, but added that it would be judged on its implementation. We are what we do, not what we say, he told the crowded final session of the summit.
Here is Stephanie Kelton, a US economist, who is a star in the new movie, Finding the Money. Here is the audio from a preview of that movie. Many people see the modern monetary theory, MMT, as one of the solutions. Yes, one of the solutions to the climate crisis.
So much of the public discourse, it's like we're going through life with one eye shut and one eye open, and we're only getting half the picture. And then somebody like me comes in and says, well, let's make sure we see the full picture. People naturally think, wait, government deficit, bad. This is a negative thing. Let's stop this right now. And I say, hang on, let's open the other eye.
The government debt is not a burden on anyone.
The national debt is exactly the opposite of what the orthodox story tells us.
This modern monetary
theory.
What is MMT about, and why has it suddenly exploded?
The last thing we need is some harebrained theory.
We're broke. America's broke.
Congress has spent all the money.
Does the government have to borrow dollars? No, of course not.
They don't find the money, they create it.
Is that what they do?
Where does money come from?
There's a theory that says we should not be looking too closely at money.
Didn't they tell you? You never touch the money question.
You're going to scare the hell out of everyone.
You could take the national debt clock that scares everyone and just rename it the US dollar savings clock.
So now don't you feel better?
The true story of money is not the story that I've been told.
Now we have another story from the Melbourne Age, and this time it's by Jim Marlowe. It has the headline, Natasha's Hot Home is Bad for Health, So is the Cost of Living. Join me now as we listen to the audio for that story.
On hot days, renter Natasha Ritchie tries to avoid leaving the house because her endometriosis makes it hard to regulate her body temperature. But given the cost of living crisis, one of her favoured coping strategies is becoming further out of reach. I try not to use air conditioning too much, and at times when it is cheaper to run, she said. But it's not possible when it's extremely hot. The heat can make it really hard to concentrate while I'm working from home or trying to sleep. The renter was one of 2,313 participants in the Sweltering Cities 2024 Summer Survey Report and shared her experience in high temperatures and heat waves with the advocacy organization. Of the participants, 68% said they felt unwell on hot days or during heat waves, but this was higher for renters at 80%, a cohort who have limited ability to make thermal efficiency upgrades to their homes compared to owner-occupiers. It was also higher for people with a chronic illness, 85%, and people with a disability, 90%. New South Wales and Victorian residents reported similar rates of discomfort at 67.8% and 65.5% respectively, but it was much higher in Queensland. There, 74.1% of respondents said they felt unwell on hot days. Sweltering Cities Executive Director Emma Bacon said the results reflected Australian anxieties about cost of living. This is the third round of these surveys that we've done, but what has struck me this year is how dire the cost of living impacts are, she said. It's having physical and mental health impacts on a broad section of society. About 78% of survey respondents had air conditioning at home, and 65% of those said that concerns about the cost of running the appliance kept them from using it, mirroring Richie's experience. She said using air conditioning was key to managing her endometriosis symptoms during hot days because her main strategy to deal with flare-ups, a heat pack, became unusable. In summer, that's quite hard to target the pain in that way, the Maribyrnong renter said. I can get a high temperature anyway when I'm about to get my period. I feel like I'm about to pass out and I can't get good sleep. It's just a challenge to regulate my temperature. Richie said high temperatures limited her work and social life. She was one of the 80% of participants who said they either change when they take part in outdoor activities or avoid walking on hot days. Geelong GP Jenny Huang recently took part in an open letter calling on the Victorian government to implement cooling minimum standards for rental properties, including mandating air conditioning and insulation. Huang said high heats affected a range of medical conditions and could even lead to more incidences of domestic violence. She said high heat, without the means to mitigate it, affected sufferers' ability to participate in society. I see a lot of that in my clinical practice. Those who have intellectual disabilities, they tend to not have the financial ability to ensure they have nice ventilation and air conditioning. I have patients who were pregnant, now a new mum and baby just really suffering from the heat. With that, there's irritability and domestic violence can increase. That puts pregnant ladies and their babies in a lot of vulnerable situations. Associate Professor in Architecture at the University of South Australia Lirian Daniel said Australia's housing stock was poorly suited for the climate, especially rentals. I think it's under-acknowledged that our housing is pretty poor quality when compared to our international counterparts, she said. I think this is all coming to a head more and more every summer and winter, basically because of cost of living pressures for so many households. Once it might have been reasonable to deal with the heat and cold by switching on the air conditioning, but that option is less available to people because of the cost. Daniel said climate change will make the problem worse, particularly for renters, people with chronic illness and people with disabilities. It's a problem now, but the future will become much more concerning, she said. It is these vulnerable groups that are going to be most impacted by this. We know this. We can track this through other housing problems, and we know these people have less capacity to bounce back as well.
Yes, once again, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, and I'll put as many as I can in the show notes. So go there, read them, check them out, and make some decisions. Decisions about how you're going to respond to the climate crisis. Also, I'd love to hear from you. I want to know what you think about this podcast, so you can contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, and you can contact me at that same email address, and we can arrange to talk either over the telephone or via Zoom. I'd love to hear from you. Do me a favour, put a link to this podcast on your network. Let people know what's happening with the climate crisis. It's important. We all need to know what's happening with the climate crisis, what's going on, who's saying what, why they're saying it, and who's not saying what they should be saying. So share it. Please share it. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.